Welcome to the Collections by Michelle Brown Show, a show about people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality as they create change. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services.
Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. Each week, we'll be talking with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality, and creating change. Tonight, we're talking with Mark Loveless. Mark is an appointed commissioner of a Cook County Commission of Social Innovation. He's a member of the Board of Directors of Chicago Social Enterprise Alliance, which is a national association of enterprising nonprofits and social purpose businesses. He's currently a student of social enterprise at Roosevelt University and a member of a grassroots leadership team that passed the Quality of Life Scratch-Off Lottery ticket. This ticket created in Illinois a new stream of funding for HIV and AIDS. This is the first of funding, this type of funding stream in the country. He's the founding executive director of a Coalition for Justice and Respect, an African-American, same-gender-loving, black, lesbian, and gay social justice and civil rights organization in Chicago. He's a recipient of the Trailblazer Award from Fathers Who Care and the Hope and Spirit Award from Chicago Department of Public Health. He is originally from Detroit, but Mark has called Chicago his home for quite some time. He's currently working on a book project on healthy living for black, gay, same gender loving men living in America. And he's the first openly gay elected official in the state of Illinois, having served on the local school councils of two schools in the city of Chicago, Pulaski Community Academy, and then at Sabin Magnet School. Mark, how are you this evening?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. I'm so glad that we're able to have you on, because I want to talk to you about you, but then you have a very special event coming on at the end of March that I really want to talk about and get people engaged in, because it's something that's really worthwhile. But like I said, when did you leave Detroit, and how long have you lived in Chicago?
Well, I've lived in Chicago. Well, when I left Detroit, I moved here to Chicago, and I've been here for 25 years now. And I grew up and was raised in Detroit. And although in between time, you know, as in the time when we're maturing and getting to know ourselves, I went away to college and lived in other places. But I've been here the longest. In Chicago the longest, other than Detroit, which I understand it's 70 degrees today, and I wish I was there.
Well, it's changing. Changing as we speak. You know, one of the things I recall when I first met you, actually I initially met you over the internet and on phone talking about the Coalition for Justice and Respect, but then one of the things that I heard people talk about you was your long-term civic engagement, how you have been involved with everything from Operation Rainbow Push, the Rainbow Push Coalition with Jesse Jackson, and how you have been involved in politics. And in fact, I remember one person saying, you know, one thing about Mark, he has a deep Rolodex, because if it's happened in Chicago during the time that he's here, you've been involved in that. How did you get so connected in your hometown, your second hometown of Chicago?
Well, actually, it started with Detroit. I started getting involved in politics and political stuff when I was 15 in Detroit, and worked. You know, I had just always been asked, you know, like people like would say, what do you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to do when you grow up? And I remember out of the clear mind that I wanted to be a senator. And then I had to figure out that if someone finally asked, well, what kind of senator? And I didn't know there were different kinds. So I had to figure out from that. Those were the sorts of things I began to get involved in, not just because I wanted to be a senator, but because I wanted to get into politics at all. It was just I wanted to I felt it was something that you had to do, you know, or that was a part of what you did. I didn't, you know, and it was just innate in me. And it wasn't until after I got older, mm-hmm. I really had the knowledge of knowing that this is something that sort of have been in my family for a while. I wasn't, you know, trying to emulate anybody, but my dad was one in the late 50s and early 60s. He was one of the first members of AFSCME in Detroit, and he explained to me how he got involved in it. He got involved with AFSCME because he, as an electrical engineer, someone with a skill, could not get a job except for working for the city of Detroit, and he didn't want anyone else to experience the difficulties he did, and it was based solely on race, that they didn't hire black men in that position because of the salary level and all that stuff. And my mom, who in her own right organized and worked with Michigan cosmetologists and was one of the drivers in that, and all my uncles, when I say uncles, I mean my great uncles, were involved with organizing or being a part, active members in the UAW, because they worked in the car manufacturing company. And it's just like these sorts of things. It was just like always a part of you had to do something, even if you weren't doing this full time. It just so happened I've had the opportunity to really live a life that I've been able to live this thing out. I'm sure some people in Detroit may remember Marie Farrell Donaldson.
Oh yeah.
And I worked for Marie. I was the first, when she was appointed ombudsman, I was the first appointment she made as an assistant ombudsman. And then I was eventually elevated to being assistant to the ombudsman in Detroit. And that was an amazing, amazing job, opportunity to work with her in some real trying times. As you know, Ms. Donaldson and the mayor were not necessarily running buddies. I would love to see them both now. I'm sure they're fine now together. But mm-hmm, they had a couple of challenges in their relationship, professional relationship, and I learned so much from her and from him. She is my mentor. You know, not many men will say this, but that woman is my mentor because she gave me so much about how to be effective in public service, how to strive for efficiency, you know, how we can be accountable, be held accountable, and hold other people accountable. And those were lessons that I learned, and I would not be able to be in any way confident in what I do in Chicago if not for that experience that I had learning, you know, more or less, you know, at the knee of Marie Farrell Donaldson in the city of Detroit. And when I came to Detroit, came from Chicago, it was a different situation because I came here as most people think, like you say, they think I came here from some political whatever, but actually I came here doing grassroots community work. I was appointed and given an opportunity to serve as the first gay and lesbian liaison for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and the first and one of few, actually, LGBT hate crime victim witness coordinators in the country. And it's what started is that there was a state's attorney here who the gay community was pursuing about why was he not, why the office was not more amenable to prosecuting anti-gay crimes and that sort of thing. And then they pursued that one state's attorney to the point that he started a task force, and then he came up with this position, which was a hate crime specialist and LGBT liaison. And at the time, I was traveling the country talking about anti-gay violence with NGLTF and then the Human Rights Campaign Fund before they lost the F, and mm-hmm. and was on the boards of National Coalition of Black Lesbians and Gays, which actually at the time was based in Detroit, and I was doing that work, and it was the mainstream LGBTQ community. Well, we didn't have all them letters at the time. We only had lesbian and gay. I'm going to be really honest with you. That's all we were. We were lesbians and gays at the time. But that community, the mainstream community, actually came to me and said, we have this position. This position is up. The state's attorney has agreed to do it. Apply for it. The community would support you in serving in this position. It took me a minute to think about whether I was going to do that or not, because I didn't want to seem like I'm parachuting in, save somebody. People usually can save themselves with a little help, you know. But after some conversations with people here, particularly. You know, for me, my identity is important, so I had to have deep conversations with Black LGBT folks, gays and lesbians here in Chicago. I said, because I understand where the mainstream gay and lesbian community is, I need to know where you will be when and if this happens, if I go for this position, and received some very encouraging comments. So I did. I submitted my name to, and I was chosen. Now, see, this community was very interesting, because after I submitted my name, all the other candidates that they had also submitted withdrew their names, so it made it a little easy. mm-hmm. They cleared the path a little bit for me. And then, also in the process of this whole thing of me going back and forth whether I'll do it and all that stuff, the state's attorneys changed. So it went from the Democratic state's attorney to a Republican state's attorney. So then, which was challenging, because it was like, is he going to continue it? He said definitely he would continue it. So he continued the position, had the position filled. So for the first 3 years I was in Chicago, I was working for Republican administration.
mm-hmm. Well, you know, Mark, I think that's one of the things that's interesting about you, too, is because although you are deeply self-aware, you're very authentic and open and a part of the African-American LGBTQ community there in Chicago. I mean, you have been involved in so many things. I mean, you've been on diversity and inclusion. Like you said, you worked for a Republican. You've been in Operation Push. When you sit back now, I mean, and you've been there, I would say that you know Chicago. When you hear number 45, our current president, and some of the things he often talks about Chicago like it's like a vast wasteland, what mm-hmm. is the Chicago that you see, and with all of these diverse people and communities, and you travel through all of them, even to the point where now, I mean, you're back in school. So, I mean, you're not only intersectional, you're intergenerational. What's the Chicago that you see?
You know, this is so interesting because my niece, who lives in Florida, who's very involved, who has a social consciousness too, and she was like, how do you live in Chicago with everything? I just know that that man and the White House there has no idea about what he's talking about, period. That's number one. Inclusive in that is his perception of Chicago. And he's going to have a grudge about Chicago because Chicago dealt him an unforgettable blow. When he was running, he was going to come here and do a big rally in this and at a university here, and the community erupted to the point that the police department and public safety people said, "Look, don't even stop, just keep going." And so we shut the community, the grassroots folks, as well as institutional folks, of, you know, from the streets to the suites, shut him down. So we will always be evil. So when he says things, I understand some of it comes out of his pettiness and his frustration, because he's yet to come back into the city. He's been to the suburbs, but he's not come back into the city. The city that I see is diverse. I think we're struggling with a lot of things. In regards to, there's challenges of people's capacity. I think that that there's hard looks at everything. You know, Saul Alinsky, who wrote the book Rules for Radicals, said the hardest place in the world to organize that he had found was in Chicago. And I can see what some of those elements are. So, I mean, it's like any place. Like, I'll tell you something. I love Detroit. Detroit is whatever people may say about Detroit, I know a Detroit that is vibrant, that is challenging. I remember, I've not, been back there, but that's the same thing that's in Chicago, is that there's vibrant, challenging opportunities. There are problems that we have to deal with, but the thing is, we're willing to look at them, eyes open, full, face forward, eye to eye, to really address them. You can call people out here, which is what's going on. Elected officials are being called out, public officials, because things are not, everything's not going the way that it ought to go, and some people are finding that they're getting hurt by it. And how do we help people that are being hurt or compromised or not being appreciated and all those things? So, from one end of town to the other, I literally are for 20 years lived up north. 20 of the 25 years I lived on the north side of Chicago in an area called Edgewater. And Edgewater is a diverse community that's predominantly white, but it's very diverse culturally. I mean, you will see in Edgewater, as you walk down the tree-lined streets of where there's predominantly white folks living, signs that say Black Lives Matter, and in their lawn, and sincere efforts and consciousness like that. The past 5 years, I've lived in on the south side and this area called Bronzeville, which is a diverse cultural area, which is really very, very, it's a changing, it's called, they identify as a changing community because it's changing from being just predominantly black to being a more diverse community. And this is an amazing experience. And working with Reverend Jackson and Rainbow Push, it's given me the experience to really pursue a mission and make the mission the purpose. See, when I worked for the Ombudsman's Office and Detroit, I had the power of subpoena. I had the power of the city charter, and based on that, I had the authority to come in to a department and to stop them if they were impeding an ombudsman investigation. We could stop them, and those people would have to go home. I mean, mm-hmm. and they would go home right away. And if they did not, then we had the authority to call the police to remove employees or anyone that impeded an investigation of the ombudsman. Now, working for Reverend Jackson, we ain't got no law, we ain't got no guns, we have none of those things. So then we have to rely and use something else, which is to pursue the consciousness of people, to mm-hmm. be the assistance of goodwill, to question, to call into question, and to challenge things that are unstabilizing and disruptive and that disrespect the humanity of the circumstance. And it's a different sort of thing, but it causes you to be creative in how you present stuff, and also conscious, you know, that the people who you're going up against, these are human beings too. They're people mm-hmm. just like us. They have ability and authority and responsibility, but the fact that we are confronting them, we can, you know, there is a problem if we diminish the humanity of the people that we're talking about. You know, even though I don't agree with what Mr. Trump is doing, what the President of the United States is doing, I don't believe he's well advised, and I think the people around him fail him every day. Yet and still, I understand that they are people. I'm not willing to compromise on the fact that they are human beings, and I'm not willing to disrespect them because they are people. And they're making a lot of mistakes. I know they are. I can see it. And eventually, you know, who knows? They may reach a point of realization themselves. And when they do that, I think that if we keep in mind the capacity and the failings of all of us as human beings, we could maybe. We can maybe see when those changes happen and the possibility of those changes happening become more possible.
Okay, well, Mark, we're going to take a short break in our conversation, and then we'll be right back. So you're listening to The Collections by Michelle Brown Show.
This episode of Collections by Michelle Brown is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services, bringing balance to your mind, body, and spirit. For more information or to schedule an appointment, visit the center at www.thecenterforpeacellc.com.
We're back with more conversation with tonight's guest, Mark Lovelace, here on Collections by Michelle Brown. You know, Mark, everyone has heard of, you know, Rainbow Push and Jesse Jackson, but it was around a Bolder Than Out conference that I was there, and I was supposed to meet you at Rainbow Push. And when I went in there, the history of it, I mean, it was almost like overwhelming. It was like, wow, here, this right here, this is where where it's, you know, this is what, you know, our history, you know, you saw pictures, you saw things, and there was a community, I forget what kind of event they were having, but there were all these people from all walks of life who were there, who were talking about their community, and also like what you were talking about, how do we rebuild, how do we come together, how do we remember one another's humanity? Mm-hmm. What, from all of these experiences, first of all, can you tell us what is CJR, and okay. How did that come about?
Okay. Well, so I had worked for Reverend Jackson for, I still volunteer and work there and working with other projects with him for years. And from after I had left the state's attorney's office to working for, you know, like you mentioned, the diversity committee, if anyone had told me at age, you know, 17 or 20 or 30 that I would eventually be working for the largest brokerage firm in the world, I said that ain't me. That never worked. But while I was doing that, I was also involved with Rainbow Push still, and other community group, other Black LGBT groups. Like, we formed a group called the Committee, the only political action committee of Black LGBT folks in Illinois that we know of. I mean, and we did politics. We raised money for candidates. We endorsed candidates. We took candidates from campaign trails to the Black gay bars, introduced them to their constituencies. We supplied volunteers and staff for. It was a political action committee. It was, and that's in electoral politics, and we did that. So that was something that was going on as I was still involved with Rainbow Push. I'll tell you, when I got the job to come here and work in the state's attorney's office, my first weekend, I knew where I went to the Rainbow Push Coalition. Now, I had had a little introduction beforehand because of a little bit diversion, but still an interesting connection. When you're in Detroit and you know where the Stroh River place is?
Yeah.
Okay. All of that. The Stroh River place, and you know, it's had some challenges, I know, since I was there, but that the financing of that came about because of a plan that we pushed, and I was the staff person that had to push this through the Michigan legislature, that would allow pension funds to be investors. And if you may think back when Reverend Jackson ran for president, he talked about using city employees' pension funds to spur urban development. People say what happened to Detroit is that corporate America turned their back on Detroit, and they would not invest in Detroit and no other urban cities. So Reverend Jackson had this idea. I was working in the legislature and got the Democratic Party leadership there to support us, allowing, because there was a law at the time that prevented the pension funds from being a secondary fiduciary for investment and development. And we were able to get that law changed. The governor signed it. It was Blanchard at the time. He signed it. It became law. And then that allowed the initial financing for the development of Stroh River Place and other developments, because there's a tower, some big old tower next to Stroh River Place. I forget what they call that one, but that was that we were able to leverage and get those things, that investment done, because the other outside investors, like from Sweden and those places, because American banks would not invest in the cities, we were able to get them to go along with it because we had these pension funds. So that's sort of how I had a little arrangement before I went to I came to Chicago and went to PUSH. But I had worked for PUSH and worked with Reverend Jackson all this time, and I was transitioning out of working for PUSH full-time and just sort of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And this was in 2006. I was actually, doing my own thing, again, leaving PUSH. And I got a call from, because while I was at PUSH, I was also not only, one of the areas I worked in was around HIV prevention, education, and treatment and advocacy. So a lot of the community, a lot of the people here knew me from that. Well, there came a time where the City of Chicago Department of Public Health had come up with their prevention spending plan, which had eliminated all of the Black and Latino service providers. They were just all gone. And they said they didn't have the money. So I said, well, let's talk to them. Let's have a conversation with them. So when they called me about it, we set up a conversation with the City Council Department, with the Department of Public Health, and it was an intensive conversation. And it was like, well, you know, it seems as if when we first sat down with the director of public health, who was an African American doctor, he came in and he plopped the papers down and said they all applied and they just didn't make the qualifications and it was a fair process and blah 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 blah. And I said, listen, I'm not critiquing your process. My concern is the outcome. The outcome is this. So regardless of, I'm sure your intent is pure, but your results are this. And then this pattern that we looked at that came up of Black organizations doing HIV prevention, getting funding 1 year, and then no longer being funded, being treated like the redheaded stepchild. So we had this, and the mainstream white organizations, they always made the funding cut. They never had a time when they got treated like the redheaded stepchild. They were not, no offense to redheaded stepchildren, but so we were like, what? How come that's happening? And we were able to, through dialogue, get the city and the public health department to find the extra $1 million to make sure that now that we don't have this loss of just being under, you know, so that we can get some stability as well. And so in that process, it was 2006, December 30th. I remember it well. I was at the movies and I got this phone call. Have you heard what happened yesterday? No, it was the 31st. Have you heard what happened yesterday? And I said, no. They said, well, there was a party of a gay house, a gay family, and some guys came and they shot in the house, and they were using anti-gay epithets. And then the news reports interviewed people in the neighborhood, and it was in a traditional Black neighborhood, and they said, well, we tried to tell them that this wasn't a place for that, the people who were interviewed in the community. So that sort of sparked some concern.
So when it's not a place for that, for gay people to be...
For gay people,
not
right.
Not only living, but to be having a party, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Not only not having a party, but you're not supposed to be there. Gay doesn't live in the Black community is what the pressure was. And then to add on top of that, the city issued a statement saying we would not consider that a hate crime. We just consider that crime in the hood. Okay. See, that did not sit well with people. So we had a meeting. And quite frankly, I was working on a campaign at the time for a candidate who was running for mayor. And I asked the campaign, I need a meeting space. Can I meet in our campaign office? We met, and we talked about it, and we said, well, let's have a community meeting, and let's have a broader, you know, I learned the organizing skills towards direct action from PUSH. So I was using, and it's in Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail. So we were going through all those steps. And so the next step was having the mass meeting, having what we called a community forum. We had the community, we set the date, a black lesbian couple who owned a cafe said that we could meet there, so we had sectioned off a little area there, and people in the community knew that we were meeting, and it was publicized that we were meeting. By the time the meeting took place, we figured maybe 20 or 30 people would be there. By the time the meeting took place and we started the meeting, the room, the building was full. People were standing outside. The alderman we had asked to come was not coming, showed up. The commander of the police department, we had a funny exchange there with her, but the commander of the police had sent representatives, but they were not going to send the commander. After they saw the crowd, the alderman called and said, they had said that the commander had worked all night, so he was going to take the day off. That's why he couldn't make it. Before the meeting was over, the commander found away from his weary sleep to come.
He got a
and
second wind, huh?
Yes, he found out that he has something else to do. And I can't, there's one funny, you know, all along, if you don't find the humor in some of this stuff, you'll go nuts. So we were talking about with the alderman and the commander that what we really need and what caused that is because there are no places for socializing and they were referring to the kids. And they says, you know, people, you know, the kids need a place to meet and congregate, and we just don't have no place for the kids to meet. And so they kept talking, referring to the children and kids. And the alternate says, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not certain if I support children being out at 11, 12, and 1 o'clock, you know, at night. And I said, wait, and everybody, like, all first the room started to roar, and I had to jump, says, wait, hold on just a minute. When they say kids and children, they're referring to adults 18 to last. She says, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't see why children should be up at those hours. Wait, hold on. That's part of this issue about being human. She didn't mean any offense.
Well, you know, it's a cultural thing. We have, LGBT people have a culture. Anybody who was gay understood what was being said. But there's
right.
also that culture. And when you don't interact with each other, you don't know the culture.
You got this straight black woman who is mm-hmm. trying to do, and who I know, and I knew that she was good-hearted, but that was the start. So after that, we had several things change. The city changed their position. They ended up doing a wanted poster or whatever, reward for information. And what ticked people off more than those kids, than the people they interviewed. And the funny thing is, the people they interviewed that said, we told them, you know why they told them? Because they had been up in there trying to get busy, and they could. So that was their path of telling. But at any rate, as we went from that meeting, we decided that we needed to say that this was a place for everybody in this community. So on the following, the very next MLK Day, we staged the first LGBT march in a traditional black community in this city. and we marched up 79th Street en masse with signs and posters, and so we said, now how do we want to, how do we want to identify ourselves? How do we want to call ourselves? And we came up with Coalition for Justice and Respect. And we had every single black LGBT organization in the city came. And civil rights organizations came. And elected officials came. And we blocked 79th Street. And in the dead of cold, and it was cold. And we did this like 3 or 4 years in a row. And in addition to that, we said, look, we wanted to commemorate the work of Dr. King and what we do. So that's how we would have around the 4th of April a social justice event, an event around social justice in the black LGBT community. And so we would take one subject and one topic. Then about 5 years ago, we changed that because there were so many things that were happening. There was PrEP, there was marriage equality, there were transgendered issues. All these things were emerging. So we said, you know, what to, because we had been previously focusing on one issue, having one-day conference and focusing on one topic and having a panel and saying that we've at least done that. But at this point, we realized there were so many things that were going on that one topic concentration was not going to do it. So then we came up with this concept of a conference, a social justice black LGBT identity conference. And it actually, I had marshaled it similar to, I don't know if you still have it in Detroit, but we used to have, we started a James Baldwin Pet Parker Society several years ago before I left there, and they had a cross-gender conference. And it started off, I remember the first one we did, we just said the brothers and the sisters are going to get it together, called, you know, black gay men and black lesbians. We held our a conference, and we held it for the 2 years before I left, and it was, Kofi?
Yeah,
She was a part of it. She can tell you more than I can, because we held it at Wayne State University.
How did you come up with the name Bolder Than Out? I mean, what is the significance of that?
When I replicated what was in Detroit here in Chicago, it was like, we need a term. What do we want to do? And it was like, you know, being out, you know, just to say we're out, I mean, that's a term, you know, being out and the LGBT community in general, it means something. But what we're saying is more than just, we're not just gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered or questioning. We're more than just out. It is bolder for us to, as black people, as people of color, it is bolder for us to be out. We're more than out. We're bolder than out. And that's how the concept was born.
Now, you know, when you, because I remember like that first year when you had gone from like, you always had something, but then you were trying to put this conference together. And like you said, there were so many issues. I mean, you probably could have gone on for a week, you know, to cover all of them. But there were some things that you still heard, you know, and I think that one of the things that I thought that was really unique about Bolder Than Out and that you continue to do is you bring some of our brothers and sisters from Africa to talk about what's going on there. Because often, although we are all from that same diaspora, we sometimes forget that what's happening to them. What made you decide to do that consistently each year?
And this year, we're going to begin with the report from the diaspora. well, I'm so excited. For the first time, it's going to be a black lesbian from Uganda. And, Ghana. No, wait a minute. Anyway, Nigeria, that's where she's from. She's from Nigeria, and she's going to start off that Saturday morning with talking about the experience of and the circumstances there. And that, I got to tell you, it just came about as organic as anything, because as we were putting out the information, I got a message. One message from Facebook that said, "We're in Ghana. We would like to come to your. Can we come to your conference?" And I said, "Of course." And then they began telling other people on the internet. So then we got people from Uganda, from even London. And who were either refugees and Nigeria and South Africans and all the, it's funny. It was a local thing from the start. When they heard about it, they said, we want to connect with that. And that's what, and we've done it every year since. So, and they more and more come. I end up sending a lot of letters to our State Department. I don't know what we're going to do this year. I'll be very honest. I'm a little nervous. I'm a little nervous dealing with these here people. But, I have to send letters that say what the conference is, inviting them to come and making sure that they're invited. Because they have to be invited. They can't just decide to come. So usually I get several requests, and I've been processing them as well. So, like, while I'm also pinning things down locally here and making that happen, I'm also having to deal with the, the people who give out visas and all those folks too, and contact, and they now know that it's legitimate. And that it's actually, something that happens. So like I said, this is going to be the first year with this administration. So Lord knows what they're going to do. But mm-hmm. when they see us, because I've learned a lot about international stuff as well, because the visas are granted by this, they go to the embassy, they go to the U.S. embassy in those countries that they're from, and some of them they're from towns that are not necessarily close to where the embassy is, so that's a journey in and of itself. So they get to the embassy, and then they have to wait and be concerned, and they have to be interviewed by the customs people, the customs and immigration people, and then they decide if they're going to give them a visa or not. So, yeah. And then they get a visa to come, and there you go.
Well, I guess like you said, especially this year, you're learning as you go, because, with this ban,
I don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's going to happen. Now, I know, but another thing what has been one of the biggest challenges for Bolder Than Out? I know that you and I have often talked, and that it seems to be more heavier leaning towards gay men than lesbians.
Yep.
Why do you feel what's that about? What do you feel, and what would you say to lesbians, black lesbians who are following this show and hear us talk about this? And besides that, you are welcome. What would you say to address that?
Well, one thing is I would say that let them know that you are going to be on the program for Saturday, number one. and the issues and concerns there, I think that I would say this, that as a result of Bolder Than Out, we've been able to make some inroads in regards to several issues of social justice, because out of Boulder Than Out, we were able to have an insistence of inclusion in the marriage equality movement. That is, that particularly not only in this state, but in the states where our participants come from, there's a greater visibility. So there's a effective and efficiency piece there. I think that that the issues of women, and one of the things that I don't think our community focuses enough on, and that it's is health issues around women. Okay, so we get the HIV piece, we got that. Now, because of just inevitable things, we're moving into more chronic illnesses as a healthcare priority. But even more than that, we need to understand there are some unique issues around Black women and health, and even there are some things that are highlighted amongst Black lesbians, such as breast cancer, and this is something it's a frustration to me. I knew Audre Lorde, and I know the battles that she went through, and overcoming breast cancer, and then having it come back, and then overcoming it again, and it's just that I just think that. With equal respect and consideration of the issues around bisexuals in our community, that we embrace, that are a part of our community, and we embrace those issues, as we embrace the issues of transgender women, that we have got to make certain that we are not addressing also those issues around cisgendered women and those issues around lesbians. And when addressing those issues, we get into other things such as family issues. And one of the topics that we're going to be talking about this year is, what is LGBT families? What does that look like? Because and LGBT families have, if we don't focus in and highlight the consideration of lesbians who have children, we got to understand that when we talk about, I can tell you about Black lesbians, people in my community. I see the issue around child care, rearing children, and an educational experience that is beneficial young people, as well as not offensive to their families. That's a critical issue. We need to know how to talk to school boards. We need to know how to talk to school councils around those issues. And we're going to talk about that and bring that up, and those are some of the conversations that some people may not see or consider as comfortable. We do warm and fuzzy because we're going to go to a play on Saturday night, and we're going to have our cultural dinner at the African restaurant again on Saturday. But we've got to get our arms and our energies around these issues. Because if we can address the issues around families that is uniquely a part of the Black lesbian experience, then we can address family issues and the black gay male, the same gender loving experience. If we can address the issue of pay equity amongst women and Black women, Black lesbian women, we can address pay equity of young Black males and young Black MSM males and others. We've got to, I would say, come help us raise this voice. Help us raise this issue. We will come out of it different. We will come out of it better, getting more lesbians involved, having more lesbians to want to participate. And I will say, you got to be a certain kind of lesbian, a black lesbian, to come to participate and to as Bernice Johnson Reagan would say, wade into this water. And maybe it's not for everybody, but if you're of the mindset of a Michelle or Ojeda or the other women that have come and participated in what we do, if you're of that mindset of determination, confidence, of sensitivity, of sensual awareness, knowing that you can't really enjoy your sensuality if the quality of your life is all tripped out. And right. That's where you need to come here. You need to come here so we can at least look at each other eye to eye. As Audre Lorde said, you know, what Audre Lorde, that's another, she's another one of the people that I could attribute to helping the development of me, is when she talks about eye to eye, woo, the power of being able to look eye to eye.
Well, you know, one of the things that I
would say.
When
you walk down the street. Go ahead.
Of having attended some, you know, the different ones, is that I have made friends. I mean, I have met.
Yes.
Guys who came from all walks of life, and some who are from Chicago, some who I have stayed in touch with, who I've been able to dialogue with, and I think that we've grown together. And I think that, like you said, to have this setting where you can sort of come in there and have that time to have these around issues, but also conversation and sharing minds, I think that's one of the beauties of Bolder Than Out. That I would encourage, you know, my sisters to come and sit down and talk with some of these brothers who you'd be surprised at some point at how much they are aware of, but also how much they want to be a part of. And
yeah.
I think that sometimes we make our own barriers to within our community. Well, we're going to take our last break, and then I want to come back and talk, get a little more information about Bolder Than That. Out. So
okay.
We'll be right back in a few short moments.
Collections by Michelle Brown airs every Thursday at 7 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure and mark your calendar so you never miss an episode. Join the collection at www.collectionsbymichellebrown.com.
Mark, we're back, and I wanted to ask you, what are the dates for this year's Bolder Than Out?
Okay, the dates this year are March the 31st through April the 2nd, and we begin with this year on Friday, we're beginning with a different concept, which is in Chicago, it's the first Black LGBTQ Wellness and Employment Expo, and Empowerment Expo. And what we're doing is we're acknowledging some of our leaders. You know, this is, you know, believe it or not, we have matured to the point where we got Black LGBT folks that have worked so long that they're retiring. So at the first part of the day, we're going to be acknowledging one of our sheroes, Dr. Margot Bell, and she has been working with Black LGBT youth and the Ball community for years. And so she's going to be recognized. And then we're going to talk about PrEP and why that's important to us. I mean, CJR is a part of a demonstration project that's funded by the CDC and Chicago Department of Public Health to do an outreach on awareness around PrEP and the Black community amongst Black MSMs. And transgendered and cisgendered African American women around PrEP. And the reason is because they realize that after, you know, 3 to 5 years of this actually being on the market, 78% of the people who are on PrEP right now are white men. Where we are still the first 3 months of this year, we buried at least 3 African American MSMs under 30 from complications of AIDS, full blown 80 style AIDS. So this is something that we're experiencing, and that we have to really get the word out that this is available. So, and also address the barriers that make people not want to or apprehensive about it. So we're going to have that. Then we're going to go into getting ready for employment, because we have here a economic and employment disparity amongst young black MSMs and LGBT. The young LGBTQ community in Chicago is suffering from a huge employment and economic disparity. So we're going to talk about some skills around getting a job, what you do when you get a job, keeping a job. If you don't, you don't have to have a job, but how do you secure your income, and what does it mean to do, and, you know, are you being paid equally? How do you say as a black LGBTQ person, how do you insist upon equality and pay parity even amongst in our community? You know, like when we're working for these agencies and stuff like that, pay equity is critical to the quality of life. We got to talk about how we address that. And then we go into that evening, and then we have a lunch where we're acknowledging the fact that Chicago, we have one LGBT liaison in the Department of Public Health, and for the first time, this position is being held by an African American man, and we're going to acknowledge him. And then we go into a ball. We're having a mini ball executive. After all of that talking and stuff, we will actually have employers here who will be looking to hire people. So we'll be having job interviews and things like that going on. And we're screening also, and then we go to the ball. It's an executive realness ball, a mini ball. Yes, CTR is going to sponsor the ball for the first time ever. And then, so that'll go on for the night. And then we go from there to the next day, which is where we begin, as you know, as I mentioned, with a report from the African diaspora. And then we'll have workshops, and which one that you're leading, and then we're having another workshop on decriminalization of HIV, why it's important to do that, and what the criminal. I mean, we, you know, this goes back to sort of what I said about the humanness of us all. When we allowed and encouraged the criminalization of HIV, we were trying to do the best we could. We thought this was a way to combat it. Clearly, it is not. It is we have learned better, and you know, hope no one's offended. But the Bible says, "When I was a child, I thought like a child, but now that I'm a man or an adult, you know, I think different things." So we were doing the best we could 35 years ago when we set these laws into place. We would only, knowing what we know now, we would only be foolish to not at this point talk about strategies on how we reverse this. And then, as I said, Saturday night we'll have the the dinner, the African dinner, and mm-hmm. then we go. And it was, and this having a Saturday night dinner be an African dinner sort of came about from our participants from Africa who came here, found communities of their of other Africans that have immigrated here, and they first cooked dinner for us, and so we've kept that as a tradition, and then we'll go from there to see, we're going to see this play that's called Booty Candy, which is from a book that about experience of growing up black and gay here in America, so we'll do that, and then Sunday we'll have a concluding roundtable and a bon voyage. What do they call that? They're going to do. They're taking. They said they're taking mimosa. Yeah, champagne and orange juice. A farewell mm-hmm. lunch.
Oh, okay. So, how do people find out, or do they need to register? How do they do that?
It would be good to register so that we can sort of get an idea of how many people to plan for. Now, the conference, because you know we've been fortunate in that we've been able to have underwriters and stuff, so there's no real conference fee. But there are things that you might want to do, we now have hotel rooms that will be available at $135 a night, but that goes strictly to the hotel. It's at the Hyatt at McCormick Place. They just sent me the email confirming that Thursday. I haven't got that up on the website yet, but they can go to our website. They can go to Facebook, look for Bolder Than Out. They can go to Eventbrite and look for Bolder Than Out in Chicago. And you can, like I said, it's good to register, you know, just so that we are aware of how much who we need to accommodate for, you know, numbers of mm-hmm. people as far as food and those sorts of things. We don't want people to, feel that they were, even though there's no registration fee, we don't want people to feel mm-hmm. that they were, not treated well while they were here. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think hopefully the weather will be nice and a nice spring weekend for that. Well, Mark, I know that CJR does have a website, which is www.cjrchicago.org, where you can uh-huh. learn more about the coalition. And there's a page to get involved where you can put in and you can get information from that. Mark, I want to thank you for being with us tonight for the month of March. Each night we are doing our part to remind people about Bolder Than Out and encouraging them to sign up and come. And I look forward to seeing you at the end of March for Bolder Than Out.
Same here. All right, then. Okay.
Mark.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. And like I said, my best to ever of my Bolder Than Out family there until I see you.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mark. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. Again, that is the Bolder Than Out Conference in Chicago. I mean, the conference in and of itself is worth going. But, you know, anyone who knows, Chicago is a beautiful city. You'll meet beautiful people and get to learn something, you know, all in the one package. Again, that's Bolder Than Out, March 31st to April 2nd. You can find out more about it at cjrchicago.org. And there is, you heard him say, you don't have to pay a fee, but they would like for you to register because, heaven forbid, you show up and there's no chair for you. But you know what? We'll all scooch over and make sure there's room for you. Until next week, this is Michelle Brown. I want to thank you for listening to Collections by Michelle Brown. We will be back bringing you another introduction to someone who is living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change. That's each Thursday at 7 p.m. right here on Collections by Michelle Brown. Good night.